Okay, Ezekiel chapter 43. And I think Tosin is making sure that everybody has a handout, but flag him down if you don't have one or don't end up with one. Okay, we are making our way through the final section of Ezekiel, which is perhaps a little challenging, maybe a little bit weird, this elaborate description of the temple complex and the land that God is showing to Ezekiel in a vision. And so thanks to Rick for helping out on Sunday and teaching through chapters 41 and 42. And what we tried to do when I taught a couple weeks ago or last week, and what Rick did very well on Sunday, is provide some context for what we're looking at and go through the text. And we'll do that tonight. We will at some point hopefully get to reading through the text of chapter 43, talking about it. But we are going to begin with a discussion to try to place some of these things in the broader context of what's happening in Scripture, which I think will make not only the reading of this easier to understand, but also what the application of this, which we will also hope to do at the end, a little bit easier to do. So we're going to go back to Eden again. I know we've referenced creation and the Garden of Eden. We're going to go back and look a little bit closer at Eden and compare and contrast that with the tabernacle and with the temple. Then we're going to read through the text, talk about it, and particularly notice in this chapter what God says about why he wants Ezekiel to tell the people about this weird vision. Okay, and then we will connect these elements. Hopefully you can leave with at least one element of chapter 43 and how it's fulfilled in Jesus. Okay, so you have on your handout the first side is working through some of these thoughts related to the creation account in Genesis 1 and 2. And I'm happy to spend as much or as little time on this as you want to, if that makes sense. So I'll start working through it. If you want to stop and ask a question about something or make a comment about anything in this section, by all means, please. If we spend all class on this, it won't bother me. We are not in a huge rush, although we don't want to dawdle and, you know, knock it through things at all. But if you want to stop and talk about it, let's do that. If you have nothing to say and I kind of, you know, speak my piece and we move on, that's great too. So, in the beginning, remember the first verse of the Bible, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the very next statement says that the earth was two things that are said in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. The earth is without form and it is void. What does the word void mean? Empty, right? Empty. So, two things with the earth in the beginning. It is without form, without shape, without order, we might say, and it is empty. Okay, so those are the two things that God is addressing, so to speak, over the course of the days of creation. First, God is forming, okay, ordering, and then he is filling. And we mentioned this before, but now I've given you on your worksheet the details of this. And notice that this is a parallel structure, okay, where day 1 and day 4 match up, and day 2 and day 5 match up, and day 3 and day 6 match up. Days 1, 2, and 3, God is separating, he is gathering, and he is what we might say ordering the realms, I think that's what I put on here, or the habitations, the spaces themselves, okay? And then on day 4, 5, and 6, he is creating. That's when we start to see the language of making or creating the inhabitants. Okay, what is going to fill or inhabit these realms? And again, you see the parallelism. On day 1, the realm of the light, the realm of the dark are separated. And then on day 4, the lights or the heavenly bodies for those realms, the sun, moon, and stars, are created to fill that space, so to speak. And it's easier to see with day 2 and 5. The waters above, the waters below are separated on day 2. So on day 5, the sky is filled with birds and the seas are filled with fish. And then on day 3, this is the dry land that's gathered into one place out of the seas. And on day 6, that is filled with beasts and then ultimately with the humans, of course, as well. Okay. So we have this two-part pattern in the days of creation. The ordering, remember, it was without form, so God has to order it. And then it is void, so then God fills it. And then on day 7, he rested. And we've talked about this at some length in, or at least I have, in the lesson we did on the Sabbath a few months ago. And remember, this idea of God resting is not that, okay, he's tired, so he took a break. But it is that God kind of sat down to enjoy what he made, to fill the earth with his presence. Remember, he sanctifies, he makes that day holy. His presence in the creation sanctifies that day, because this day 7 is the picture of what God was always intending from the beginning, okay? To create the world, to put man and woman in the world, and then to dwell with them in the world, okay? His presence filling creation. Okay? Any questions on this so far? So the ordering of creation, the filling of creation, and then God's presence dwelling in creation. So that's Genesis chapter 1. And then in Genesis chapter 2, we have another picture, a more in-depth picture, we might say, of the creation, and a particular creation of man and woman. But notice the way that the text reads, particularly in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 8 and 9. So we have the earth that was created and the dry land that was created in Genesis chapter 1. And we're told about a place called Eden in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 8. And the language of Genesis 2 is that it says that God planted a garden in Eden. So subtle, easy to miss, but you see that the garden is in Eden, right? And then we may remember that in that garden, in the midst of the garden, there was a tree of life. So you see there are some levels here. In all the earth, there is a place called Eden. In Eden, there is a garden, and in the garden, there is a tree of life, okay? And then a couple other interesting details. One is that the very next verses talk about waters flowing out of the garden and filling the whole earth. This is one of the ways we can tell that Eden was kind of one place on the earth, because it talks about the rivers that flowed out of Eden to the rest of the earth. Okay, but store that image away of waters coming out of the garden. And then the only thing we'll say about the creation and the charge of man in Genesis chapter 2 is that the man is given by God two responsibilities in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15. He is told to tend the garden. That word translated serve or work or cultivate, okay? This is what I've called a productive purpose of man. He's supposed to work to bring forth fruit, okay? But tend the garden, serve, and then to keep it. And the keeping word is more what I call a protective idea, sometimes translated to guard, okay? So to keep or to guard the garden is his other task. So two tasks: to tend or to serve in the garden, and also to keep or to guard the garden. Okay, any questions or comments so far? Yes, Mike.
Naturally, since Dustin works at NASA, I follow them on Facebook and Twitter and all that type of stuff. And just yesterday or today, they were identifying some planet Y, blah, blah, blah. But they said it was entirely water. And, you know, that made me think back to here, to where we started out the water and then God pulled the land out of it. And and plus the pictures they've got are just fascinating. But how you can ever see those pictures, not think of God, I don't know, but people do. But anyway, so evidently there is some other places that type of phenomenon exists, that they're was water that was the planet, and then particularly with us, God pulled the land out of the water. So I just thought that was cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Thank you for sharing that. And remember that Genesis 2, the rest of that verse, we said it, the earth is without form and void, and it says, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the water. So that seems to be the picture, actually, of earth is the waters. And then, as Mike said, there's a couple different things that God, he separates waters above from waters below. Water vapor, I guess maybe that refers to in the clouds, I don't know, atmosphere. And then, as he said, gathering the dry land out of the waters. Okay. We are getting somewhere, although I think this is interesting regardless, but we are getting somewhere here. If you look at this, I've kind of laid it out in sentence format, try to be a little bit creative. These concentric zones, right, of the earth, and then Eden, the garden, and the tree of life. It looks something like this, okay, if you diagrammed it out, okay. Within all the dry land is Eden. Within Eden, there's a garden. Within the garden is a tree of life. Now, this is maybe where it starts to turn some of the gears. Does this look familiar to anybody, this kind of diagram here, this diagram of space? Looks like the tabernacle, Denise, doesn't it? Okay. And this is particular, this is exactly the layout of the tabernacle and then the temple. And we're going to, if we say one or the other, remember both tabernacle and temple are essentially the same, especially in their layout. One was the portable sanctuary that traveled around with the Israelites in the wilderness and then was in the land at first, and then the temple was built as the permanent structure designed by David, built by Solomon. But you can see that the tabernacle and then the temple was designed with this same sort of structure, the same sort of ordering. And it's, and in some ways, you know, seeing it in the tabernacle or temple then helps us maybe to, you know, go back and overlay it on the garden. But remember with the tabernacle, what happens as you move closer? You know, the courtyard, the holy place, the holy of holies. What do you remember about the instructions in the tabernacle or temple? Okay, so there's purification. Yes, thank you, Terry. That's required, like every step of the way, more and more. Okay, and then did you say something, Jordan?
Sanctification.
Okay, sanctification, purification. What else is true about each layer? From even from the outside the courtyard to the holy place to the most holy place.
Closer to God,
yeah, that's kind of where we're ending up here. It's like the Holy of Holies is the hot spot of God's presence, right? And then everything else is kind of, again, lesser and lesser. But because of that, who can go into each of those areas? The list is smaller and smaller and smaller, right? And layer on top of that, even the people that can go all the way in, the high priest into the Holy of Holies, a very elaborate sanctification process once a year to go in on the Day of Atonement, okay? But you see how it is a representation of the layout of the creation temple, we call it, okay? So creation itself was a temple of God. And so the tabernacle and the temple represent this. They mirror this in both in Exodus and in 1 Kings. We talked some about those passages, but for now we'll say that these are mirrors of that original pattern, okay? But we keep going here. In both the case of the tabernacle and the temple, there are ceremonies or festivities that take place over the course of, you guessed it, 7 days, okay? And they look different, and the chronology is a little bit hard to know exactly, but in Leviticus chapter 8, you have the consecration of the priests, okay? And only once the priests are consecrated can they serve in the tabernacle, okay? So the tabernacle's built, and we talked about, well, I'll show it to you on the next point here, that in Exodus chapter 40, the glory of God fills the tabernacle, okay? I'm not that concerned whether the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle before the 7-day purification process for the priests or after. But the point is both of those things are there. You see a 7-day purification process for the priests, which is the only way they're able to serve in the tabernacle. And you see this this moment where the glory of God fills, rests in the tabernacle. Okay? And the same sort of thing happens in 1 Kings chapter 8. Okay? There is 7 days of feast that kind of consecrate the temple that Solomon has built. And there is that same moment where the glory, the cloud, fills the temple with God's presence. Okay? So, both of these points point back to, again, that pattern of creation where there was the 7 days of laying it out, okay, and, you know, the habitations and the inhabitants, right? And then there is the filling, the blessing of God, which is God filling that space and resting, dwelling there with his people, okay? And finally, what we'll say about the tabernacle and the temple is that the priests who serve in these places are given essentially the same commands. At least the words that are used are the same. And they're actually both in Numbers 3, 7, and 8, right? But you can see them all throughout the book of Numbers and in other places in the law of Moses. The priests are told to serve or to do the work in the tabernacle, same word as tend in Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. And they are told to keep their charge, same word from Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. And there even we see in the layout of the camp in the book of Numbers, the Levites camped immediately around the tabernacle, not only because they were involved in working in the tabernacle, serving, but also because they had to protect the tabernacle. They're like the military guard in case anybody was going to intrude on the holy presence of God. Okay. Any questions here? Basically, what we've done here is just we've kind of seen the temple pictures and descriptions in creation. We see how the tabernacle and the temple are pointing back, representing that you know, that creation temple in the layout and the, you know, how God fills it, and then how the priests serve in it. Anything through here? Okay. The point here on your handout, it says, what's the point? The point is that God created humans, and all of this that we see in Eden particularly, but even in the temple, helps us to understand the reason behind it. God created humans to dwell with them, to live with them in relationship, okay? Remember the Sabbath rest. This is God dwelling with the people that he made in his image, okay? God creates humans to partner with them in the ruling of creation. Remember, they are told to rule, to have dominion on the earth, okay? And they're supposed to do that in submission to God and in partnership with God, we might say. Okay? God created humans to enjoy with them that relationship, and particularly to enjoy the fruitfulness of the earth with those that he had created. And he created humans so that along with them he could fill the earth with his glory. Okay, so obviously he fills it himself. He comes to dwell in the creation. But I think the idea of Genesis 1 and 2 is that as the humans are multiplying and filling the earth, that was the command they were given, that as God's image bearers, the more they multiply and the more they fill the earth, the more the earth would be filled with the glory of God. So this is what God wanted, what God desired from the beginning, okay? And the temple and the tabernacle are reminders of that, okay? And they serve for God's people to be the place where God sits on his throne and rules over creation and also dwells with his people. So the tabernacle and the temple are a reminder of that purpose for which God created humans, okay? I have a question for you, but first I want to, any questions you have or comments you have on this? Okay, so here's a question. We're thinking about these parallels between Garden of Eden, creation temple, and then the reminders of that in the tabernacle and the temple. What element, I'm sure, as I put this together, I'm like, I know there's going to be multiple answers, and I don't want to say there's wrong answers and right answers. Well, sometimes there are wrong answers and right answers, but there's a little bit maybe of a mind-reading question, but I'm confident that someone will get it. What's an element of the activity and the worship in the tabernacle and the temple? For all the similarities, what element of temple worship was not in Eden? My mind's that easy to read. Or maybe I did a good job crafting the question. That's exactly right, okay? There's no need for sacrifice in the Garden of Eden, even though it's a temple. So why is there sacrifices in the tabernacle and the temple when there wasn't in the Garden of Eden? Okay, so with sin, so that would be like Genesis chapter 3, with sin comes the need for sacrifices. And why do you need sacrifices in a world of sin? Okay, so a word we would use, a good Bible word, is atonement. Okay, and what does atonement make possible? What is atonement? How someone comes to you on the street, hey, what's atonement? I've been reading my Bible. What's atonement? What would you say? Okay, it's a payment for sin, and it restores what? Fellowship, relationship, man to God. Okay, and to me, that especially thinking of the temple and the tabernacle as pictures of the creation and pictures of Eden, essentially, it makes all the more sense of why those atoning sacrifices were needed. Okay, because the tabernacle or the temple, what's it a picture of? God dwelling with his people, okay, resting, filling this space, okay, where, you know, heaven and earth overlap, so to speak, and he sits on his throne among his people, he dwells with them, he has relationship with them, okay, and that's an amazing thing, but there has to be atonement for sin, because sin is what sin is what kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden in the first place, to miss that. By the way, we learned this, just to kind of, you know, pile on here. We learned this in Genesis chapter 3. When Adam and Eve leave the garden because of sin, what is then at the door of the garden? Yeah, the cherubim, okay? And remember how those images show up in the tabernacle and in the temple as well. Kind of that reminder even of we've been removed from this because of our sin, but God is offering restoration for it, at least in the tabernacle and the temple, but there has to be atonement. Sin has to be dealt with in order for us to have this this dwelling place of God among us. So that's really kind of what we're getting at here. Yeah, Jordan?
Maybe one point to that. You know, in chapter 3 of Genesis, I think you could maybe make the argument that the Lord provided possibly the first sacrifice for the atonement and whatnot, and then we see that representation with Jesus.
Yeah, then you're referring to this animal skins. Yeah. Yeah, so Jordan points out, a lot of people have picked up on this. It doesn't take away from Jordan's brilliance here. Okay, but no, the animal skins that God gives to the man and the woman, people thought, well, where did he get those animal skins, right? So maybe there was an atoning sacrifice there. And just maybe to confirm that, what's the first thing we find people doing in the next chapter of the Bible in Genesis 4? Yeah, offering sacrifices, Cain and Abel, okay? And some, by the way, you can look up, you know, diagrams of this. Some have very cleverly, you know, diagrammed the Garden of Eden and then put the altar where Cain and Abel offered sacrifice right outside the Garden of Eden, like would be in the Temple of Solomon. You know, that altar was right outside the entry, okay? But maybe, you know, not that, but the idea is perhaps there. From now on, humans being kicked out of the garden, the sacrifices are needed to atone for their sin in order to walk back into this fellowship or relationship with God. Okay, so with that as our context and two-thirds of class gone, let's jump into Ezekiel chapter 43, okay? Let's read a little bit here. This first half of Ezekiel 43 is, in some ways, the high point of the whole vision, okay? We've been referencing it before, anticipating it. You know that it's coming. But Ezekiel 43, in verse 1, it says, then he led me. Remember, Ezekiel is seeing this vision. He has an angelic guide who's leading him through the temple, the complex, and measuring things for him, telling him what things are. Ezekiel 43, verse 1, then he led me to the gate facing east, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the east. And the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. And the vision I saw was just like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and just like the vision I had seen by the Kabar Canal. And I fell on my face as the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east. The Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, I heard one speaking to me out of the temple. And he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne, in the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the people of Israel forever. And the house of Israel shall no more defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their whoring and by the dead bodies of their kings at their high places, by setting up their threshold by my threshold, and their doorpost beside my doorpost, with only a wall between me and them. They have defiled my holy name by their abominations that have been committed. So I have consumed them in my anger. Now let them put away their whoring and their dead bodies of their kings far from me, and I will dwell in their midst forever. Verse 10, as for you, son of man, describe to the house of Israel the temple, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and they shall measure the plan. If they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them from the design of the temple, its arrangements, its exits, its entrances, that is, its whole design, and make known to them as well all its statutes and its whole design and all its laws, and write it down in their sight so that they may observe all its laws and all its statutes and carry them out. This is the law of the temple. The whole territory on the top of the mountain all around shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the temple. Okay, again, we've already said that this happens. Here we read about it in chapter 43. The glory of the Lord comes from the east and fills the temple. And Ezekiel says himself that this is the same appearance of God's glory that he has seen now twice in this book. The first time he saw it, he was sitting in Babylonian exile, and he looked up and saw the glory coming to him. So he's in the east, and the glory is coming to him. And then he got a vision of Jerusalem in chapters 8 to 11, saw all the idolatry, saw the abominations in the temple, and saw that same glory which was in the temple get up and slowly make its way out of the temple, out of the city to the east, and hovering over the Mount of Olives. So the picture was clear. God was leaving his people. Now, in this this temple vision that Ezekiel sees, he sees the glory come back. He's fallen on his face once before. He falls on his face again. I guess you don't get used to it, I guess, seeing the appearance of the glory of God. So he falls on his face, and he is picked up and instructed by, or hears the voice of God. God's filled the temple, then from out of the temple he hears the voice. Okay, and God says these beautiful words, this is the place of my throne, the place of the soles of my feet. I will dwell in the midst of the people of Israel forever. Okay, and it does seem to be that forever that is an exclamation point in this section, because of the separation that had previously taken place when God did leave his people because of their sins. Okay? And then to that point, because God is now setting up his throne among his people once more, he's going to dwell with them forever, so what? What does God say has to now happen going forward? Or maybe the other way, can't happen. What is no longer going to happen because of this filling of God's glory with his people? Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Veronica. All of that defilement, all those abominations have to be put away. They will no longer defile his name. There's a couple things mentioned, the whorings or the harlotries in verse 7, your translation may say. We remember that like from chapter 16, among other places. And in Ezekiel, whoring or harlotries refers to what for the people? Yeah, idolatry. Okay. The worshiping of other gods, being unfaithful to God in that way. It's also used of their trust in other nations, but I think particularly their idolatry. And then one maybe particular form of idolatry, although we haven't really read about this before. It's a little bit confusing to know exactly what was going on, but it seems like they had set up monuments, shrines perhaps, to the kings that had died and were, you know, setting them right up there next to the temple and worshiping them alongside their worship of God. It's another version of the idolatry or the false worship that they had been involved in. All of that has to be put away because God is coming back, okay? God is holy. So if he's going to dwell with his people have to be holy as well. And so he tells Ezekiel, describe what you've seen to the people that they may be ashamed of their iniquity. So this is the question I want you to help me with, okay? All that we've seen so far, I mean, we've seen like the wall is this many cubits high. The gates are this many cubits wide. There's this many rooms. There's a courtyard. You know. How is all this description of the temple supposed to, as he says in verse, God says in verse 10, make the people ashamed of their iniquities? Yeah, ideas about that? What about this vision in Ezekiel would bring shame upon his hearers?
Thank you. God says, this is my temple and I will dwell here forever. No matter what you do, you will not defile this any longer.
Thank you, Christy. And it reminds them of the fact that they did that in that old temple, being the reason God left, as Christy pointed out. Jordan, what do you have something, Dan? Okay. Jordan?
Short comment. So Rick talked Sunday morning about just the magnitude and the scalability of this new temple. And so maybe you can make the argument that, hey, they messed up this smaller version. Now what has God done? He's right. It's something even better, even more magnificent, even broader. And so maybe.
And it's a, thank you, Jordan. That's a message of hope, but it's also a ton of gravity there. Like, this is an amazing house that we're envisioning here in Ezekiel's temple. Wow. What, grace of God, what power of God, what holiness. I mean, one of the things we I don't know how much we've emphasized it, but one of the things I think we should see in this description of the temple is its perfection, okay? Somebody pointed this out, the numbers all around, okay, even the squareness, heard Mike make that, you tried to pass that off to me. I heard you say that. That's right, yeah, that's right. You know, the dimensions, the geometry behind it is not just simply, although maybe partly this, that, now I have a picture of this because I can see it in my head because I know how long or the shape or whatever. But it's a picture of perfection. It's square. It's exactly, every gate is exactly the same, okay? All of this is we've talked about the ideas of order and all that with God, what he's doing. But that gets back to the holiness and the perfection of God, right? So all these things I think about the temple, its magnitude, its perfection, its reminder of why God left and destroyed the old temple, as Christy pointed out, all of that would come to make them ashamed. And as we've seen before in Ezekiel, we don't tend to like shame, but in this instance, we see again, the shame is necessary because out of that shame, they put away, they are supposed to, as he said, put away all these things that defiled God's name so that he can dwell with them. And he says that the law of the temple, the statutes need to be kept. I don't know about you. I read this paragraph and I thought, well, is God saying that they need to build this temple? Because he's saying you need to observe all these things. Okay, but I think the text actually helps us out here. After saying that you need to observe all its laws and its statutes in verse 11 and carry them out, he tells us in verse 12 what the law is. What's the law? What's the, we might say the principle? What's the main point of the temple for God's people? It's holy. It should be holy. And we've talked about that with the barriers. We saw that in chapter 42. It keeps the holy in. It keeps the common out. So the principle of God's temple for his people is holiness. That's what the people are supposed to keep and observe. Yes, Mike.
Well, it seems like on starting in verse 10 that he's telling Ezekiel to, when it says describe the house of the of Israel, the temple, it's more of a general description from what I'm getting, that, you know, this is the general description of why it's there and the holy place it is and all that. And if they take that to heart and are ashamed by it, then give them the particular exact descriptions of how to build it and where to build it and when to build it and all that type of good stuff. So it's almost kind of falls back to what you're saying to begin with. It's the general description. It's the holy place. You know, this is where God dwells. What have you done? I've kicked you out of Jerusalem before for defiling it. And if they're ashamed by those types of descriptions, then give them the particular descriptions of exactly how I want it.
Yeah. And Jordan had asked a couple classes ago about, you know, whether this was intended to be built or what they did with it. But again, remember, we said then, we'll say it again, when Zerubbabel and Jeshua get to work building a new temple, they don't build this temple, they build another temple. I think that's to Mike's point, okay, that maybe they got the lessons of Ezekiel 40 to 48, but then when they got to work, they built something else. My guess is, Mike, that they just built what they had from before, right? The plan from before, maybe on a smaller scale, they didn't have the same materials, but essentially recreated Solomon's temple. Well, I mean, there's no record that God gave them any new instructions on building the temple, is what I would say. And so when they went to build, they just built what they had previously, which was Solomon's temple, or the same layout as Solomon's temple. Does that make sense? What's making you say they didn't follow
the... When he follows it so detailed about the design and all that, and then, as you say, they didn't do it that particular way. Yes. That if they didn't, when they didn't do it that way, then that is not following all the laws and everything that he gave them.
Yeah, I've seen other people say that, if this is what you're saying, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that God did want these specifics, and they missed by not trying to build these dimensions. Is that what you're saying? I just want to make sure you're...
Rolling forward to Revelations anyway, but that's okay. I can't say that word. But yeah, along that line.
Okay, because I've seen that theory before, that this was, or something like it, was what God wanted the exiles to build when they went back. They didn't. That's a, you know, it was their mistake. It was their disobedience. My opinion is that if they were supposed to build this, that would have been clear to them, and they would have tried to build it. Again, I also mentioned that there's some things about this that are not realistic. Now, that may be your point about, well, God would clarify for them along the way. But I think this is what we're seeing here. The principle is holiness. It's symbolic, not go build this. That would be my opinion. Yes, Jeremy.
Brian Haley says they built the temple according to the law, the pattern of heaven.
That to me harkens back to like the tabernacle, the basic layout that we saw earlier of the tabernacle was given to Moses from the mountain, from the heavenly vision. That kind of rolls over into the temple, the permanent version of it, and that's what they build when they go back from exile. But
keep in mind, God, if you're talking about Eden, God built that temple.
Right, exactly.
He gave the instructions for Solomon's temple, and then to Mike's point, I don't read this to say that when Ezekiel sees this, that this is some sort of man created, like no one built this, right, other than God, which would be a reference back to how it was in Eden.
Sure. Yeah. And then Rick, you had your...
Or they understood it to be spiritual. Or, as some people would say, it applies to a future date when it will be literally built. But I think they took it as a spiritual case. And, in fact, these dimensions probably wouldn't have worked in Jerusalem anyway because he had it taking place on a high mount, not Jerusalem, somewhere else. So, to me, it indicates that they took it as a spiritual application, which is summed up in be holy. And the Lord has given you another chance. He's taken care of all this perfection. He's cleaned it out, and he wants you to be a holy people.
Thank you, Rick. Any other? Last word, Mike, you want to?
From
Yeah, that's right. Okay, we're going to quit here and pick up in the middle of 43 on Sunday. This is a preview. The rest of chapter 43 describes the altar, which is right here in this very center of the temple complex. And it looks something like this, although a couple of these things, I'm not sure where they're getting, you know, like the uncut stones, cut stones. I didn't see that in the text. But basically, you get a sense of the scale here, the kind of, you know, building up to the hearth of the altar. And then maybe the most confusing thing to us is the horns of the altar, because we're not, you know, familiar with altars. The horns of the altar are, you know, these little pokey things here, which were a common feature on all altars, and they're covered in blood with the purification of the altar. But we'll pick up there on Sunday. And do notice the last question on your handout, this go-around, about seeing Jesus in all of this. Seeing Jesus in the presence of God filling the temple, seeing Jesus in the altar that stands in the middle of the temple and is purified and provides atonement. So maybe we have some of those conversations on Sunday, but we'll pick up there in the middle of 43 and try to work through some of chapter 44 as well. Thank you, everybody.